This is the second of a three-part series entitled Love Calls Us to the Things of This World, the poetry of William Blake, John Donne, and Gerard Manley Hopkins. These sessions are led by Roald Tweet. We'll first read from the Divine Meditations of John Donne, number 10. Batter my heart, three-personed God. For you as yet but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend, that I may rise and stand, or throw me. And bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I, like a usurped town, to another due, labor to admit you, but oh, to no end. Reason, your viceroy in me, me should defend, but is captive, and proves weak or untrue. Yet dearly I love you, and would be loved fain, but am betrothed unto your enemy. Divorce me, untie or break that knot again. Take me to you, imprison me, for I accept you enthrall me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste, except you ravish me.
Feeling responses? There were a lot of good responses yesterday, so I keep hoping that we get the good ones today. Any questions about it? Does it recall anything else? That, any other images that you're familiar with? Do you like it?
The terms of force that are used are those used in battle against another male type. We'll get back to what you're talking actually about the feminine viewpoint. And yet he finishes the line with ravishing, which I suppose out of my own perspective, it generally applies to a woman. And
So are you saying this is a male poem that turns into a female poem?
It seems to culminate in a term that to me has feminine connotations, or should be associated with women.
Okay, but it does maintain the violence. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're certainly correct in saying it's a very violent poem. Notice the opening. It doesn't begin with a kind of sweet opening that we've come to think of as poetry. There are no hearts and flowers here. Batter my heart, three-personed God. It's an outright statement. It's a statement of violence and outrage. Batter. Where else have you seen images like Ben is using here? Only maybe quite differently. When he says batter my heart, what's he comparing himself to?
Okay,
let me look at the first few lines again. Yeah, the fortress, I think, this is a sonnet, and it's a Shakespearean sonnet in that it has three sections of four lines each, and then a concluding kind of message or couplet. And each of the four stanzas develops a different metaphor, but all of them are violent. Batter my heart, three-person God, for you as yet but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend, that I may rise and stand, or throw me, and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. What image? You know what he's talking about there?
He wants to be made completely new. I'm tearing down.
Made what? And what does he imagine himself as?
Crystal?
It's not crystal. Steel, well... Or some kind of metal.
Yeah,
right. What's the more usual image?
Glass?
You all use it. You all have sung a Bible campus song, right?
Clay.
Clay. And with God as what?
The potter.
Right. God, I am the potter. I am the clay. You are the potter. And again, that's a much softer. If it isn't feminine, at least it's a much... come on in. Have a sheet of... there's a chair in there too. Just avoid the airplane. Yeah. Okay, certainly the thing that we grew up with is that in a sense we are the clay which God is shaping and molding. And Donne, what's the difference between the way Donne imagines his relationship to God? Here. Between imagining yourself a vessel made of of some kind of metal.
He's not pliable.
He's not pliable. It's something that has to be battered and beaten. And so he begins those kinds of paradoxes, that I may rise and stand or throw me. In other words, that I may become a vessel standing upright. You're going to have to turn me over and put me in the fire and get me red hot and just beat me, absolutely beat me into shape. So this first quatrain, I think, depends upon our much softer perceptions of, traditional perceptions of God as potter and we as clay, easily made into the image that God wants us to do. Doesn't say, no, for me, batter my heart. For you as, and I'll look at the interesting part of the second line, for you as yet but not breathe, shine, and seek to mend. What do you make of the not breathe, shine? Where does knock come from?
Is that requesting admittance?
Sure, where's the knock from?
Revelation.
You knock, behold, I stand at the door and knock, right? Mm-hmm. Knocking, done saying, for me isn't enough. Mm-hmm. You can't just knock. Breathe is what?
Breathe on me, O breath of God.
Okay, and shine?
That's the light of mine.
Okay. Okay, why do you think he uses three there? Knock, breathe, shine.
He just called it three times in God.
He called it three-person God. Knock would be who?
Jesus.
Right? Breathe?
Spirit.
Probably God the Creator, breathing the breath of life. And then shine would be the Holy Spirit. So notice how neatly now he's taken this sonnet form, which is three parts, and used it to illustrate the three-part God. Also, it's true of a sonnet, if you've ever tried to write sonnets, if you've ever tried to write any particular form, a sonnet has absolutely rigid rules. A Shakespearean sonnet has to have a certain writing scheme, ABBA, et cetera, all the way down. It has to be an iambic pentameter. It has to have three metaphors and a concluding couplet. There isn't any choice there. It's not pliable, in other words. So that as Donne talks then about a God who has to absolutely beat him into shape in order to make something, he is doing it in a form which is extremely rigid and very hard to fit and must be put into a mold. And he's doing it in a form that has three parts. So the form here partly substantiates the content. Notice that for him, knock, breathe, shine becomes break, blow, burn. Taking shine and extending it to burn. Breathe becomes blow and knock becomes break down. For me, you have to break down the door. So here's a person then who is describing his relationship to God in extremely violent and extremely male terms, I think. What's unusual about that is that most of us get, don't we, a kind of Sunday school image of God as somebody who is a very gentle father who does not. The knock, breathe, shine are the three things that I remember from my childhood. But Donne is denying that's enough for him. You have to come to God. He does, at least, in a different sort of way. Okay, now, the middle stanza then, or the middle section of this poem, contains another metaphor where you do get the fortress. I, like usurp town to another, do labor to admit you, but oh, to no end. Reason your viceroy in me should defend. But is captive and proves weak or untrue. Okay, now the images of violence. What he's saying there, essentially, is that I'm like a town that's been taken over by somebody else. I belong to you, but I've been usurped. The devil has taken me over. And reason, at the fall, has become weak. Reason your viceroy in me should defend. Notice one other thing. I don't know if we can call this a male trait, or even traditionally a male trait, but notice the harshness of the rhythm and the rhymes and the sounds that Donne is getting into this poem. Not only is the poem itself very rigid in form, but it's almost as if it's trying to break out of that. It is untraditional in so many ways. So untraditional, in fact, that it wasn't really until the 20th century, until 1915, 16, 17, when T.S. Eliot sort of rediscovered Donne and the school of poets of which he's a part. Donne is writing this in 1611, 1612. about Shakespeare's time, so very, very early in our tradition. For a long time, this kind of poetry was regarded as weird and strange and crotchety. It's full of puns. It's full of harsh sounds. It just doesn't sound like traditional poetry, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-la-la-la-la-la, at all, because most of our traditional poetry comes from the influence of the French period of following the Norman conquest. But notice that Donne's poetry is very hard to read, and it doesn't sound pleasant. There aren't pleasant images in it. They tend to be always images of violence. Batter my heart, free person, God, for you as yet but not free, shine and seek to mend. Notice how many of the words are one-syllable words. As yet but not free, shine and seek to mend. It's very difficult to read. It's full of punctuation where you don't expect punctuation. It's impossible to read smoothly. That I may rise and stand, or throw me and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. And then lines like, reason your viceroy in me should defend. So we're getting away here from a very traditional kind of poetry toward a kind of violence, a kind of muscularity that is typical of John Donne. And then he concludes the following, and each of these stanzas, in a sense, becomes more violent. First of all, the image of an artisan crafting a vessel. That's not so bad. It's just a little bit more, it's just a little bit stronger than potter and clay. Then images of violence and warfare, as if my relation to God is a warfare, in my body is a fortress being taken over and fought with for God. And then finally it comes to what is essentially a feminine metaphor, but one of violence, one of rape and ravishment. And so forth. Yet dearly I love you, and would be loved fain the same, but am betrothed unto your enemy. Divorce me, untie or break that knot again. Take me to you, imprison me, for I, except you enthrall me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste except you ravish me. It ends then with a paradox. How can somebody be raped and be made chaste by that rape? Well, in the terms of Donne's Christianity, that's exactly what he's saying. Now, let me backtrack a little bit. I want to make sure that I get some Blake in here too, and we can continue this at another time. But John Donne, let me say, lived in a world, and maybe that's one of the reasons why the 20th century rediscovered him. If you'd gone to any college and taken literature, let's say in 1900, you would never would have even come across John Donne's name in the poetry books. You would have, at the end of some of the anthologies, found John Donne's name where they put also Rands, and it would have said something like a writer of weird experimental verse in the 17th century. Donne was absolutely out. Wordsworth was in, Burns was in, Shelley and Keats and Byron were in. And then all of a sudden the 20th century, which is also a world that seems to absolutely be going apart in all sorts of directions, comes in, and suddenly we rediscover the metaphysical poets. And today Donne is one of the great, by critics regarded as one of the great English poets. But that's, I think, because he really speaks to our age too. Our age is not an age of meekness and mildness, of Christ the Lamb, but of something that has to be much harder than that. Donne's age, specifically what was happening, was that the old scholastic system, which had lasted from Aristotle all the way down, the old system that had the earth at the center of the universe, that had everything in its place, that had all the arguments from the top down. Aristotle, for instance, said that a salamander, because it was cold and moist, if you ever pick up a salamander, you'll know what cold and moist is. If you dropped a salamander, said Aristotle, into a fire, which is hot and dry, the properties of cold and moist and hot and dry will repel each other, and a salamander, therefore, said Aristotle, could live in the fire. Nobody disputed that, because argument was by authority, by deductive reasoning. All the way down, it's hard to believe that some kid somewhere didn't drop a salamander in the fire. But apparently he didn't, until in 1603, shortly before Donne comes on the scene, Sir Francis Bacon literally becomes the first scientist in the world, the first experimenter. When he took a salamander, dropped it into a fire, it lasted 3 seconds, and disproved 1400 years of Aristotle. And the new way, new science is coming in. New discoveries, new geographical discoveries. This is also the age in which, at about the time Donne is writing this, Shakespeare is writing in The Tempest, Oh, Brave New World, that has such people in it. We're moving away from heaven to this earth. We're moving from an old scholastic religious system to a system that is multiple, to a system that is looking at things here and now, to a system that is suddenly the earth is no longer the center of the universe, suddenly everything seems to be flying apart. And it both creates a kind of heady freedom. Now we're out from under the, you know, the eyes of God, but also some kind of despair. Where do we go from here? So it was a very, it's an age, I think, exactly like the 20th century. And in Donne's poetry, in the next poem that I want you to read, we'll see Donne move back and forth from the two worlds in which he is and increasingly being pulled apart. The critic Marjorie Hope Nicholson calls this period the breaking of the circle, the perfect circle in which all our questions were answered, all our eyes were heavenward, now begins to move apart. And Donne is sort of the last poet who is vainly trying, desperately trying to hold both worlds, this earth and its new discoveries and its new science, together with the old heaven-centered kind of vision. And to do that, he has to resort to paradox and to pun and to violence, because he's literally being torn as his age is both ways. Either you go into the new age and become materialistic, rational, latitudinarian, as you said, or you look back to the old age and try to retreat. But it's very difficult for religion and this life to compete at the time that Donne is writing. Furthermore, Donne himself in his personal life, I think, is aptly describing his relationship to God here, too. Donne had a reputation for being a rake, a series of mistresses. Jack Donne, Happy Jack Donne, his friends called him, and he celebrates many of his mistresses in his secular poetry. At the same time, then, that he was a very secular person and very loose morally, he was also a very, very devout priest, an Anglican priest, and in fact was Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral. The equivalent of that would be what being pastor of Riverside Church in New York or something. But it was one of the prestigious positions in the Anglican Church. And he served well there, too. But there are, in a sense, two John Donnes. As I suppose, in a sense, there are two of him and one of us. But the violence then in Donne is partly his own personal. It was difficult for him to come to God, to be beaten into shape. It wasn't potter and clay. But the age is also falling apart. Now, look at the second poem, Hymn to God, My God, in My Sickness. The last part of this was not run off, I discovered. So let me read through this. This was written by Donne about 8 days before his death. He knows he's dying. He has preached to other people about accepting death, and in a sense, this is Donne coming to terms with his own death. So it's a very real poem. He's not just imagining this. This is really happening. But notice, particularly in this poem, the terms that come from all the new discoveries of geography and so forth, and at the same time, the old religious images that hold over from the old system that the world is leaving. And it creates, again, not quite as much violence in this poem, but it creates a very, very interesting tension and all sorts of puns along with very serious things. Let me just give you an example of a pun. Wherever you can imagine a pun in Donne, you ought to put it in. Since I am coming to that holy room wherewith I choir of saints. Choir means two things. Some people that sing and a group of sheets of paper. Right? And he means both of those there. That's a pun on the word choir. Okay, let me read the whole thing, and then let me go back and simply point out to you the... okay, here again, he, in a series of metaphors, he imagines his relationship. He starts out imagining himself getting ready, the same way you do when you go on stage with an instrument. You tune up and squeak and squawk and get it all out of your system. And that's what he's doing to himself. I'm going to soon be in that holy room. I'm going to practice my instrument. Since I am coming to that holy room, where with thy choir of saints forevermore, I shall be made thy music. As I come, I tune the instrument here at the door, and what I must do then, think now before. Whilst my physicians by their love are grown cosmographers, and I their mat who lie flat on this bed, that by them may be shown that by that this is my southwest discovery, per freedom fabris by these straits to die. I joy that in these straits I see my west, for though their current yield return to none, what shall my west hurt me? As west and east in all flat maps, and I am one, are one, so death doth touch the resurrection. Is the Pacific Sea my home, or are the eastern riches? Is Jerusalem, Anyan, and Magellan, and Gibraltar? All straits and none but straits are ways to them, whether where Japhet dwelt, or Cham, or Sem. We think that Paradise and Calvary, Christ's cross and Adam's tree stood in one place. Look, Lord, and find both Adams met in me. As the first Adam's sweat surrounds my face, may the last Adam's blood my soul embrace. So in his purple wrapped, receive me, Lord. By these his thorns, give me his other crown. And as to other souls I preach thy word, be this my text, my sermon to mine own. Therefore, that he may raise, the Lord throws down. Notice that he ends again, as Donne frequently does, with a pun, with a paradox, rather. How can the Lord raise by throwing down? Well, if you stop to think about it, if we didn't die and were thrown down, we wouldn't also go up. So man is one of the few creatures who can go up by going down. That's part of the Christian mystery. Therefore, that he may raise, the Lord throws down. Now, let me go back to those first couple of stanzas. The first stanza comes from the world of music, particularly, I suppose, a small chamber thief who is going on stage to perform at one end of an eating hall. I shall be made thy music. As I come, I tune the instrument here at the door, and what I must do then, think now before. I'm going over my part. I remember the lines and so forth. Then you get into the, all of a sudden, from music you move into the new science. Here's a world that is going off in all directions, and done by bringing it back together again is trying to hold the circle together. Whilst my physicians by their love are grown cosmographers. What do you mean by that?
Physicians are left to discover what other people are going on.
What's a cosmographer?
A map maker.
How are his physicians making maps?
They're looking at him, but they can't follow where he's going.
Okay, they're looking at his body and saying, well, look at that line there. That red gash doesn't mean... Yeah, his physicians have become geographers.
And then they also, about this time, started doing digging up bodies and doing the first autopsies.
You see bodies with lines on them and so forth. Right. Yeah. Whilst my physicians by their love are grown cosmographers, and I their map who lie flat on this... Why is his description of himself as a map good? Particularly a flat map. Why does he insist on being a flat map? First of all, he's flat out in bed. But what's true of a flat map?
There's a distortion.
It's distorted. And so a person sick on his bed then is like a distorted map, exaggerated, the North Pole and the South Pole are far larger than they ordinarily are. I their map who lie flat on this bed, that by them may be shown that this is my southwest discovery. What southwest discovery? Specifically, geographically, what's the southwest discovery?
South America with gold and treasure.
The Straits of Magellan in South America, right. And now notice that he suddenly begins to pun on the word strait. Having introduced a geographical term, you can also, a strait is not also straight. Mm-hmm. You can be in straitened circumstances. And Donne certainly isn't straight in circumstances. He's straight out in bed. but also straitened circumstances means a third thing, uptight and in trouble, right? I'm in straits. And in fact, as he says, this is going to be my Southwest discovery. I'm going west. West has always been the kingdom of death. The old world only had three directions. Noah had three sons, and they went to the three known parts of the world. There was no west in the old world. Three wise men came, representing again the three known parts of the world to visit the Christ child. The west was always a mythical kingdom. St. Augustine argued that if there was really a land to the west beyond the Atlantic Ocean, it would be it wasn't a land for which Christ died. There would be no humans there. And that has led to our difficulty with the American Indian. It was very difficult for us to accept them as human because all of our mythology had made us see in terms of three, and now all of a sudden there's the West. So Dunn here is using, first of all, the new discoveries of the West, but also the old myth that the West is the kingdom of death. And I'm going through the straits. And in fact, these straits are going to kill me. I'm really in straitened circumstances. I joy that in these straits I see my West. For though their current yield return to none, you can go from Atlantic Pacific, but not back again. Also, you can go from life to death, but not back again. What shall my West hurt me? And then also, if flat maps are distorted, also, there is no difference between East and West. There is no difference between life and death. What shall my West hurt me? As West and East in all flat maps, and I am one, are one. Notice the awkwardness again, the deliberate awkwardness of the line. That people until the 20th century just couldn't imagine being beautiful or moving or poetic. But here again, very difficult to say these lines. What shall my West hurt me? As West and East in all flat maps, and I am one, are one. So death doth touch the resurrection. And then the poem begins to move out and moves back to the old Christian mysteries. Is the Pacific Sea my home, or are the eastern riches? Is Jerusalem, Anyan, and Magellan, and Gibraltar all straits, and none but straits are ways to them? The only way to God is through a strait, through death, through straitened circumstances. All straits and none but straits are ways to them. But literally, this is geographically true too. Jerusalem, Anyan, Magellan, and Gibraltar, you all have to go through straits to get to them. And then he goes back and picks up an old Christian myth that the tree on which Christ died, from which the cross was made, was the very same tree that Adam ate the fruit of in the Garden of Eden, and that Calvary and Eden are the same physical location. Metaphorically, in a sense, that's true, because the two Adams, the new Adam Christ and the old Adam, both had thorns. Christ had a crown of thorns, but Adam too was cursed with thorns. And so he begins this paradox and pun about, I am two Adams. Look, Lord, and find both Adams met in me. As the first Adam's sweat surrounds my face, may the last Adam's blood my soul embrace. And then the conclusion, much smoother, much more of what we think of as typical poetry. So in his purple wrapped, the his being both Adams. The first Adam is blood. The flesh and blood of man. So in his purple wrapped, I am wrapped in the blood of Adam, and I have sinned through the blood of Adam, but also the purple of Christ's royalty. So in his purple wrapped, receive me, Lord. By these his thorns, both the hises, the first and the second Adam, give me his other crown. And as to other souls I preach thy word, be this my text, my sermon to mine own, therefore that he may raise the Lord throws down. Okay, moving on very quickly because we only have about 10 minutes left. Let's turn to William Blake. What I tried to point out in John Donne then, that in his relationship, because of his age and because of his own temperament, was full of violence, was pulled in all sorts of directions, and Donne is being very honest to that vision that he has. He is trying to hold the parts of the world together. If you're familiar with the rest of Donne's poetry, you'll see the same thing. He can pun and be serious at one and the same time because that's a way of holding these worlds together. Now, a couple of hundred years later, or 150 years later, there appeared on the scene one of those writers who probably would have written the way he wrote had he been anywhere and in any time. and that's William Blake. One of those writers who doesn't seem to owe a debt to any previous writer, and whom no writers have imitated or been able to imitate since then. That is, he is not a part of a tradition. Donne is a part of a school of poetry known as the metaphysical school, all of them religious, all of them writing the kind of poetry that Donne wrote. Blake comes in the Romantic period, and it's when he's taught in schools, he's taught as a Romantic poet. But in a sense, he's one of a kind. There was in Blake's world, and apparently this occasionally happens to people, and they end up getting called mystics, no division between this world and the next. At the age of 4, Blake saw, when his brother died, saw angels come down and take his brother's soul up to heaven. He frequently went out in the meadow and talked to God, sitting in tree branches, walked with God in the meadow, held God's hand. And I think to understand Blake, whether you can accept this or not, literally, you have to understand that Blake believed that this was true and that this happened. So that Blake could move from that other world to this world with absolute ease. And the contrast then in Blake's paintings, and I have a book over there that of Songs of Innocence, this colored all of Blake's doing. If Donne is a harsh poet, Blake can at times almost be childlike, because in a sense his relationship to God never went through the wrenching agony that it did for John Donne. It's much easier than even Potter and Clay. I want to take two poems, one from Songs of Innocence that you might be familiar with, The Lamb, and just to give you an example of how much different the poetry is as a result of how different Blake's thing is. For Blake, nature and man and God are all part of one thing. So that in this particular poem, the lamb both represents a child, and it represents the Christ child, and it represents a lamb. The lamb is all three things here. For Blake, there's no distinction. The technique is used is not the harsh sonnet form, but the catechism technique, which is to ask a question, answer it in the same form. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Gave thee life and bid thee feed by the stream and o'er the mead? Gave thee clothing of delight, softest clothing, woolly, bright. Gave thee such a tender voice, making all the vales rejoice. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Little lamb, I'll tell thee. Little lamb, I'll tell thee. He is called by thy name, for he called himself a lamb. He is meek and he is mild. He became a little child. I a child and thou a lamb. We are called by his name. Little lamb, God bless thee. Little lamb, God bless thee. Notice the ease and the beauty and the simplicity of life. There is no veil to rent or go through, or no battering necessary. The result of that then is that if you turn to the introduction to Songs of Innocence, the one that's on the top of the page, let me end with that. I would like to cover the tiger, because that is from the companion work to the Songs of Innocence. But look at what Blake is talking about here. Yesterday we looked at Richard Wilbur and the way in which Wilbur talked about a difficult gallop. Okay, let me just go through it and then ask you a couple of quick questions. Piping down the valleys wild, piping songs of pleasant glee, on a cloud I saw a child, and he laughing said to me, pipe a song about a lamb. So I piped with merry cheer, piper, pipe that song again. So I piped, he wept to hear. Drop thy pipe, thy happy pipe, sing thy songs of happy cheer. So I sung the same again, while he wept with joy to hear. Piper, sit thee down and write in a book that all may read. So he vanished from my sight, and I plucked a hollow reed, and I made a rural pen, and I stained the water clear, and I wrote my happy song every child may joy to hear. Do you have any sense or have any idea what's happening in that poem?
like his muse.
What?
Is it his muse?
The child on the cloud?
It would have to be Christ as a child, the Christ child.
It could be the muse, the Christ child. Okay, and what happens? What's the plot of the poem? It seems to be repetitive until you start looking at it. Then what do you notice?
He's asking to sing.
Not
to
first.
To play and sing, and then to write down.
Then to play and sing, then to write. Mm-hmm. Why that order? And why, at the moment he says write, does the Christ child vanish?
I would feel that he wants it so that we can see the joy, hear the joy, be able to sing and tell the joy, and then write the joy.
What happens when you sing a joy and then write that joy?
Others, you can send it out to others who maybe didn't have the same experience.
That's right. Them. Other people can experience it, but what else happens?
Three dimensions to one.
When you take, what do you mean three dimensions to one?
The experience is gone.
That's right. When you try to put into words, which are part of this world, something that you have a vision of and experience that's dear to you, there's no way you can do it. What does he mean when he says, "I stained the water clear"?
Well, when you write in invisible ink, you have to have a special trick to read to bring the words back. Do you not?
Well, Blake literally, in order to write, had to stain water to make what?
Mm-hmm. He's making it clear.
No, he's making it unclear.
I took clear water, right?
But in order to write, you first of all have to make something opaque, ink. And that's right. That suddenly becomes one. Suddenly, the experience of song, pure music, becomes mixed with imperfect words and music, and then finally becomes just writing. And I made a rural pen, a crude pen. I scratch marks. That isn't the experience itself. That isn't the child on the cloud, and therefore the child disappears. But it is the child who was told him to sit down and write, and to somehow take the things of that world and bring them down to this world, that every child may joy to hear. Writing is the only thing we have by which we can communicate. Words are the things we have. They're stained. They're impure. They're what is left of the vision that we have. But that's the progress as we move from music to song. Music, not everyone can understand. Words are there, they're down on paper, but they're not the thing itself. And so here, too, for Blake, there's a problem in trying to translate what the poet sees, the child on the cloud. As long as the music is there, the child is there. He laughed to hear. So I sung the same again while he wept with joy to hear. Piper, sit thee down and write in a book that all may read. So he vanished from my sight, and I plucked a hollow. Notice there again the empty terms, a hollow reed, to fill with ink. But it's hollow, it's empty. It's a rural pen, and it's full of stained water. Let me read, end, I think, by just reading one other William Blake poem that isn't on this list. I don't want to leave you with the impression that Blake had no social conscience at all, wasn't aware of this world and its problems, and lived in a kind of fog in which there were children on cloud at all. Blake is living in a time, particularly as Blake looked around, he saw children being mistreated and maltreated. And for Blake, one of the symbols of that becomes a chimney sweep. Chimney sweeps, as we now know, and in fact as they knew then, had to be children in order to be able to get down chimneys. But in doing that, the hydrocarbons from the soot got on them, made them black, artificially black. And for Blake, there's a difference between being really black and artificially black. But more often than not, within 4 years, it killed them. So a child then, being sent out by his parents at the age of 6 to be a chimney sweep, knew, or his parents knew, that he had about 4 years to live before he got cancer and died. It's the price parents paid, it's the price children paid. And so as Blake looks at the chimney sweep then, going to England, The chimney sweeper's cry used to be sweet, sweet, sweet. And Blake turned that into weep, weep, weep. And imagines the kind of world in which we could do this to children, let alone doing it to anyone else. But I think Blake is also, if I have it here, I may not, are my books, okay, now, let me find it. Blake also wrote one of the first, I think, poems that would be right at home in the Civil Rights Movement. Here again is a poem called A Little Black Boy. And again, it takes the idea that, here again, Blake is trying to struggle with this world and the world up above. I'll just read it. He is imagining himself as a black child in Africa. My mother bore me in the southern wild, and I am black, but oh, my soul is white. White as an angel is the English child, but I am black as if bereaved of light. My mother taught me underneath a tree, and sitting down before the heat of day, she took me on her lap and kissed me, and pointing to the east began to say, look on the rising sun, there God does live, and gives his light and gives his heat away, and flowers and trees and beasts and men receive comfort in morning, joy in noonday. And we are put on earth a little space, that we may learn to bear the beams of love, and these black bodies and this sunburnt face is but a cloud and like a shady grove. For when our souls have learned the heat to bear, the cloud will vanish. We shall hear his voice saying, come out from the grove, my love and care, and round my golden tent like lambs rejoice. Thus did my mother say, and kissed me, and thus I say to little English boy, when I from black and he from white cloud free, and round the tent of God like lambs we joy, I'll shade him from the heat till he can bear to lean in joy upon our father's knee. And then I'll stand and stroke his silver hair and be like him, and he will then love me. Well, Blake is very aware of the problems of the real world, but for him again, ultimately, it is all answered in a way that is totally affirmative, that doesn't need the kind of violence that Dunn needs. The idea that Blake is playing with here is the idea that this world is a prism through which we see the pure light of God that would be too hard to look. No man can look on God and live. And so as we look at nature, it's like a prism with all of its colors reflecting the light. Until, as Blake says, we get used to it. And gradually, we will get used to the pure brightness of God, and then we won't need these bodies anymore, and we can die and go to heaven. The black child can simply absorb more of these beings than the white child, who will get sunburned if he takes too much, and so will need protection when he gets to heaven. But it's a beautiful poem that combines Blake's mystical vision of the world with the realities of the harsh realities of the world in which he lived, where cruelty was present as it always is. Okay, any questions or comments about these two poems? I've done too much talking today, and I really didn't intend to. Tomorrow we're going to do Gerard Manley Hopkins, who is, I suppose, of all the Christian poets, my favorite, and for a long time has been regarded as the Holden Village poet, even though he never was at Holden, died a long time before it was born, was a Jesuit priest, but who really represents, in many ways, the spirit of Holden. And as a Jesuit priest, he really struggled with what to do with the things of this earth. If are they important or aren't they important? If they're important, how can they be important? How can we pay attention to those and attention to God?